From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, soul singer Sharon Jones talks about returning to the stage after treatment for pancreatic cancer.
That's my therapy, being on stage. You know, I mean, it's like this cancer is here, but I want to perform. I don't want to be home just taking medicine and waiting to die.
The new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Barbara Koppel, is about the period in 2013 when Jones couldn't perform, when she was getting months of chemo and recovering from extensive surgery.
They had to cut through the diaphragm, through the stomach, remove stuff. They removed like 10 pounds of things that I never gained back.
After the chemo, she did a world tour with her band, the Dap Kings. The cancer has since returned, but she's still performing. And our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the phrase law and order, its evolution, and the racial overtones associated with it. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Please welcome Miss Sharon Jones.
My guest is soul singer Sharon Jones. Her music is inspired by the classic soul and R&B she grew up with, by performers like James Brown and Aretha Franklin. She's backed by the horns, guitar, and rhythm section of the band The Dap Kings, which also backed Amy Winehouse on her album Back to Black. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings are known for their showmanship, reminiscent of 60s soul revues. Jones is a powerhouse. But in 2013, she was diagnosed with stage 2 pancreatic cancer, had extensive surgery, and months of chemo. After finishing chemo, recovering from the surgery, and getting clean scans, she returned to the stage and did a world tour with the Dap Kings. But then the cancer returned. The new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, is about the first 7 months after her initial diagnosis. The film was directed by Barbara Koppel, who won Oscars for her documentaries Harlan County, USA, and American Dream. Let's start with a song from the soundtrack of the new film, a recording that was also used in a Fitbit commercial. This is 100 Days, 100 Nights. Sharon Jones, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new movie. Can I start by asking you how your health is now?
I had chemo yesterday. The doctors took me off of one chemo medicine, the one that's causing a neuropathy. I told them I didn't want to take that anymore because it's really causing more pain and stuff in my legs and causing a problem. But today is one of my best days. In the last few days, you know, I'm on and off. I take it one day at a time. And being on the stage with them, performing and opening up for Hall & Oates for the last 2.5 weeks. And then doing 3 nights in a row, one day off, three. So I did like 9 straight nights and a day off in between there. So, but I feel pretty good.
That is an insane schedule when you're in chemo. That's just insane.
That's my therapy, being on stage. It's like this cancer is here, and I have to take the chemo, but I want to perform. I don't want to be home just taking medicine and waiting to die. You know, that's not something I'm about. So as long as I got my health and the energy, my voice is great. So there's nothing wrong vocally. I just want to be able to get on stage and move around.
So making a documentary about you, after you were diagnosed with cancer in 2013, that was the idea of your manager, Alex. Why did he want to basically commission a documentary?
Well, he went to VH1, and knowing VH1, because I know the story now, hearing it from Barbara Koppel and everyone, it's great. And he was like, there's a story to be told here. And VH1 being fans and wanted to do it, they took it on, and they asked Barbara Koppel to direct it. And she's been a fan, read up on me and what it was about, and chose to do that. And here we are today.
What did you initially think of the idea? And forgive me for asking something so straightforwardly.
Excuse me.
But if I were you, I probably wouldn't know whether this was going to end up as an obituary or a triumphant return to the stage.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think once Barbara Coppola took it on and the band, my goal was to, I had a February date, and my goal was to be back at that date. And everything in the filming and the, there's a scene with the church scene, that was my first time even attempt to sing after months. And that's when I knew from the church scene that I was ready. I was going to be ready for February. I knew I was going to have the strength, you know, my faith and my belief and in myself. I knew I was ready to go back out. And I knew that sickness wasn't under to death. After I thought I was going to die maybe a couple of hours, you know, after the doctor hit me with everything. You know, you go through that. So for a few couple of hours, I was on my deathbed. But other than that, yeah, I overcame that. And doing the film was also my therapy. And I knew that it would help someone out there with cancer or going through it, as long as I inspired someone, because I was, that's where my health came from. My energy came from knowing my fans was out there and I'm getting back to them, and I wanted them to see me go what I'm going through with.
The impression I take away from the film is that you had a great feeling of responsibility for the band, because the band is centered around you. You know, there's horns and drummer and, you know, guitarist and everything, but like, you're the singer, you're the focal point. So if you're not there, the band's kind of out of work. And
it's not only, it's not only the band, it's the whole, management, my whole, you know, we got punches,
right.
We got, it's so much, you know, it's a whole big, we got an LLC, it's a company here.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a lot of people not getting paid, including myself, and one of the doctors wasn't included in insurance, so we had to pay out of the pocket money for, you know, so it was, and believe it or not, I didn't know what was going on with one of my members. Thank God they kept that away from me. But I found out on the night I watched the film for the first time in Canada.
Wait, what didn't you know about?
Like Binky going through the divorce and then, losing stuff. And like
guitarist.
Gabe not being able to get the loan, and just different people in the band, you know, lost apartments and, you know, they had to move in. So it was a lot that they didn't put that on me, you know. But I found out about it later, you know, in the filming. So, but I had already knew I had to get back out there, and I knew we had to. You know, our money is when we work.
Well, why don't we hear another recording? And
all right.
This is from an album. You had to hold back an album when you got sick. And the album
Give the People What They Want.
Yeah, the album's called Give the People What They Want. And there's a track from it that's on the soundtrack from the new documentary about you. The documentary is called Miss Sharon Jones. And so here's a song from the soundtrack, and it's called People Don't Get What They Deserve. Do you want to say a few words about this song?
Oh, no. It was just when we recorded that song, you know, we were trying to think, should we have named the album People Don't Get What They Deserve? But it came out to be Give the People What They Want. So that song was it's going to be the title of the album. Or are we going to just, you know? And that's just a great song out, you know, just a song we wrote. And it's one of our first ones that we wanted to push out to get out there in a single.
Okay, so this is a song included on the soundtrack of the documentary Miss Sharon Jones. That's my guest, Sharon Jones, singing People Don't Get What They Deserve from the soundtrack of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, which was directed by Barbara Koppel. And that featured the Dap Kings, the band that backs her. You watched a lot of TV when you were sick, but you don't say anything in the film about listening to a lot of music. Did you listen to
How
come?
Because I couldn't sing. I couldn't get air because people didn't realize I was cut across the diaphragm all the way up from right under the center under my breast all the way down to top of my navel almost. So they had to cut through the diaphragm, through the stomach, remove stuff. They removed like 10 pounds of things was taken out of my body.
You're
10
kidding.
Pounds and I never gained back.
Gosh.
You know.
So you can only listen to music when you can sing?
Well, I didn't want to. I was just down. I mean, here I am not performing. I've been working almost 20 years on the stage, and here it is these months. I went from May to actually September when you saw me in that church sing. It was the first time I sang in months, you know, and then I had to get prepared to do the Thanksgiving Day parade in November. You know, I had to get out there and lip sync. Even though I lip sync, I still had to be up and be around, you know.
And waving. And I mean, that's pretty strenuous when you've had major surgery.
Oh, my God, yes. And then December, I had a lot of TV shows. Different things started opening up before. And then January, I'm doing all the TV shows and all this stuff. And then February, boom, the stage. So I was preparing myself. Everything that I, you know, the singing was there. I wasn't ready to do it. I couldn't get the air in and to breathe, you know, to push it back out and so on until we started rehearsing and yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is soul singer Sharon Jones, and there's a new documentary about her called Miss Sharon Jones. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is soul singer Sharon Jones, and there's a new documentary about her called Miss Sharon Jones. It covers the time when she was first diagnosed with cancer in 2013 and went through her first round of chemo and then ended up having to get right back to work, go right back on the road. And amazingly, she did like a world tour basically as soon as the chemo ended. And now the cancer has since returned. She's getting chemo again. There's a scene in the documentary Miss Sharon Jones when you go to a church in Queens, New York, and you sing His Eye is on the Sparrow. And it's a really nice scene. I thought we could listen to you singing that. And this is, as you said, this is the first time that you sang after getting the surgery and starting chemo. So why don't we hear that?
Okay.
And then we'll talk.
Again, I just want to give honor to God. And right now, I'm going to try to sing a little bit of His Eyes on a Sparrow. And I sing because I'm happy. And I sing because
you were not holding back.
No, I was letting it all out, and I was, you know, and it's that's a difference. And anointing came over me. I just opened my mouth, and they just come out, you know, and the air just flowed, and that was like I said, from that thing, I knew that God had watched over me, and He had me ready. I was gonna be ready for February.
Why did you choose that song to be the first song and to be the song that you sang in this small neighborhood church?
Because if he watches over a little sparrow, you know, If he take care of the birds, a little sparrow, here I am, one of his children, you know. We got so many of us down here, human beings that send our faith up and believe. And if he watch over a sparrow, I know he watches over me. And that was the song. And it was about I'm singing, you know, because I'm happy and I'm free. When I get in church and I sing, and I mean, singing is my life. And when I can do that, that's when I'm free. That's when I'm at my happiest. I'm at my most.
What was the importance of the church in your early singing life?
I think it just prepared me for what to come out here. I mean, it prepared me for when I was told I didn't have what it took, which I knew I was a singer. But y'all was looking, they was looking for looks and style. And
right, you were told you were too short and too black.
Too
and
fat, yeah.
Too fat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just, I didn't make it there with that. The younger, you know, when I was in that youth in my late 20s, 30s, and 40 was my first album I got a chance to record. And the reason why I got a chance to record that, because we built our record label and started Daptone. And then they finally got a label so I can have an album out, Dap Dipping. And we don't have to worry about if I sold 5 or 5,000 or 500. The record label wasn't going to fold under or fire me because I didn't sell, you know, a million records or whatever. So we started that so we can do our music the way we wanted to and get me out there.
Since we just heard you sing in church, tell us about the early churches that you sang in when you were a girl.
One of my churches was in the South, South Carolina, right across the bridge from Augusta, Georgia. But that was the church my first time ever attempting to sing for the Nativity Christmas play. I played an angel, and I got to sing Silent Night. And I was like maybe 8, 9 years old, and I remember, you know, doing that, and I was like, and those people are true, that little girl can sing. And I think right then and there I knew that I was going to be a singer. You know, God had blessed me with a gift to sing.
Did you sing in choirs, or did you usually sing solo?
Well, at that time, I was young. I just sang with my sister. My sister, Willa, we used to sing a little duet, like, take the love with you. Oh, and she'd take a verse, and I'll take a verse. And you know, that's how I was just going from there. You know, and then later on in the church in New York, I started going to that church at 14, and I just directed choirs. I never took any kind of vocal lessons or teachings of how to. I never even took piano lessons, and a voice just came to me and said, go play the piano in church. And I followed my bass player and my guitar player, and I just started playing piano with two fingers, and I just started playing my chords, and that's where I'm at. And listening to Aretha, who was my biggest inspiration, and when I saw her on the Amazing Grace album, and she had that dashiki on, and she was did this song, Mary Don't You Weep, and that was one of the songs, I said, I'm gonna play this piano. And I can actually play a couple of Aretha songs, but I only can play gospel on the piano and stuff. But that was a big, and Mary Don't You Weep was one of my songs that I learned how to play and sing of Aretha Franklin.
In the documentary, you say that you feel like a different person than you were before you got sick. And that when you started performing again, you basically wanted to figure out who you were. Who was this new Sharon Jones, and who was this new Sharon Jones going to be on stage? So do you feel like you've been able to answer that for yourself as a performer?
Yeah, the night I went out there, it was like, it was a different Sharon because the hair is gone. That energy, I mean, everyone said my energy was great, but I didn't feel it all. Like Binky always said, 110 pounds of soul. I felt like that night, maybe I gave like 90 of it, or, you know, a little less. And even now, the days on the stage, I'm just not myself. I don't have that energy, and the legs doesn't lift up like I want to. With the pain, the neuropathy from certain chemo is like, it's a hinder. But I do the shows, but it's not the same.
Right, because you, for anybody who hasn't seen you perform, you do a lot of dancing and jumping around on stage. You are not still. So I could see how it would be very difficult to do that with neuropathy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's some nights it's tough, like I said, and to get past that pain and you know, and each night it seems like once Binky said, Miss Sharon Jones, and I walk out there, all the nerves gone, all the nervousness, And the pain, you know, I fight through it. You know, those first couple of seconds or the first 5 minutes, it's the most that I can get through it.
I have to say, though, there's a point in the movie where you say, if it comes to a point where you have to sing while sitting in a chair or on a stool, that's when you're going to retire. And I thought, that's ridiculous. I mean, there's so many singers I love, like jazz singers, who spent so much of their career just sitting in a chair or sitting on a stool singing. And, like, that was great for me. I mean, I love your voice. Like, why wouldn't you just sing sitting down if you needed to?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to if something like that happened the way you just went. I'm like, okay.
I mean, really, like, don't retire if you end up having to sit down and sing.
Maybe then I'll hire some dancers to come out and start dancing around
fine,
the stage.
Fine. My guest is Sharon Jones. She's the subject of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones. We'll talk more after a break, and our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, will trace the evolution of the slogan, Law and Order. This is Fresh Air.
You call me your woman, then you go and do me wrong. Expect me to carry on. Life is good. We always hurt each other, even though we're miles apart. You leave me with a wounded heart. Oh, girl, you. Loving you is so easy to do. You can say that we're through. I'll still be through.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, automotive partner of the National Park Service Centennial. Subaru encourages people to explore America's treasures and discover a national park adventure at findyourpark.com. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. And from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week, from grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns. Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with soul singer Sharon Jones. The new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, is about the first 7 months after she was diagnosed with stage 2 pancreatic cancer in 2013. During that period, she recovered from extensive surgery and had a long round of chemo. She returned to the stage after those 7 months, but the cancer returned and she's back on chemo, but still performing. Let's hear a song that's included on the soundtrack of the new documentary. Here's Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings with If You Call.
I've been laying alone for hours, but I haven't slept at all. These eyes are closed, but I'm listening for your call. For your call. These feet too tired for walking, to crawl, but these arms are strong enough to hold you. If you call, if you call, am I dead?
That was Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and that song is featured on the soundtrack for the new documentary about her, which is called Miss Sharon Jones, and the documentary is about when she was diagnosed with stage 2 pancreatic cancer and had to undergo pretty serious surgery, very serious surgery, and have a long round of heavy-duty chemo. We were talking about returning to performing after the surgery and the chemo and figuring out, like, who is Sharon Jones now that you've gone through all of that? And it seems to me like you're trying to be this, like, powerhouse on stage, but allowing yourself to be just a little vulnerable on stage. Like, when you first return at the comeback concert at the Beacon Theater in New York, you still have a little bit of chemo brain, and you're worried you're going to forget the lyrics. And you do on the first song. You blank on a couple of words.
First couple, yeah.
Yeah, and you explain it to the audience. You tell the audience what's happening. They're totally with you. But yeah. I bet being even like the least bit vulnerable on stage was something kind of new to you.
It was new to me, and that's why I take the time. I have to talk about it, because if I don't talk about it, it'll hold me back, and I won't concentrate. I'll be concentrating on that, you know, of what's going on. And I, even now when I get on the stage, I tell the people what my day, you know, it's tough back here. I've been sitting back, you know, I've been in pain, but I get through it, you know, and I let them know that, you know, I'm not wearing my little fancy dancy heels anymore. I got to wear these shoes because they're comfortable, you know, just got to wear what's comfort, or I take them off when they're not. And once I tell the audience how I feel, I relax, the pain go away. Or I can deal with it. Now I'm not thinking about it, and I'm just there to let the audience know, and they see that I'm, you know, that's my therapy. That works for me. So I talk about it and go ahead and do it.
So you said that when you're on stage, like, the pain is gone, you know, you are totally in the music. But do you have to pay a price for that, like, the day after?
Sometimes, or not even the day after. As soon as I get off the stage, I can go to the dressing room, and maybe another half an hour later, I can barely stand up, you know, I didn't stiffen up again, or, you know, sometimes, and then the other time, I'm like, whoa, I feel great today, you know, so, it's I just keep saying that over again, one day at a time, each day is a little different.
And the band understands?
Oh, the band, I learned certain things, even if I'm not, like, feeling, like, I'd be in a lot of pain, and if I tell them I'm in a really lot of pain and they see that in my face, it sort of gets them down, because all night they're watching me now, you know. And sometimes I might tell them I'm really, you know, a little pain. So Gabe would start off too slow or calling slow songs, and I look at him like, pick it up, you know. And so I've learned now, I'm like, no matter what, I'm going to throw look at them and flash a smile. I'm okay, guys. You know, I'm all right. Pain is pretty good. I don't feel that much pain. Even if I do feel a little bit more pain, I have to get that smile and let them know that pain is not that bad, because they'll read it differently, you know, and I have to get through with it, so they're watching me.
Okay, this isn't exactly like having a documentary, but your record, 100 Days and 100 Nights, was used as music in a Fitbit commercial. And so,
a coffee commercial? Yeah, that was in a couple.
Okay, so I know you watch a lot of TV, so what's it like to put on the TV and have one of your songs in a commercial?
Well, wait, it was that one. And then also I did September for the Target. They had the, I did the cover of, what was that, Black Box? Everybody Dance, Y'all. That was me.
That was you?
Did the summer denim stuff. Yeah, that was me.
I didn't realize that.
And so I had all of this just this year, you know, just from the summer on up to the three commercials, then the fourth one with the, and then this one, the Lincoln, you see me in the commercials.
With Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah, so that was like exciting, you know. Just all this stuff happening in the last few months. And so it's really good to sit back. And you know, those things was like great for me because everything I've done and everything I've gained in my life has been with my music. Thank God I got my manager before Alex came in and started managing me. I got the opportunity to be with the Crazy Love album with Michael Bublé. And that Crazy Love album, that work recording was the down payment on my home for my mother. That's how I got my mother out of the projects and into their home from that. And believe it or not, this September passed up. It's been 6 years now since I got the home and everything. And the commercial for the Target paid off my mortgage, so my house is paid for. So two good jobs that helped me that I wouldn't have had this thing if I hadn't had those opportunities to do that stuff.
That's great. My guest is soul singer Sharon Jones. She's the subject of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life. At GatesFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with soul singer Sharon Jones. The new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, is about the first 7 months after she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2013. So I want to play a song that I suspect has different meaning for you now than it did when you first recorded it. And the song is called Retreat, and it was on your album Give the People What They Want, which is the album that you had to hold back in 2013 when you were diagnosed with cancer. And it's also on the soundtrack album for your new film. So what did that song mean to you before, and what did it mean after the diagnosis?
Well, when we had recorded that, I hadn't even thought about that song anymore, Retreat, until I'm laying in the hospital and Gabe comes up like, well, we got to do a video. I'm like, of what? And he was like, Retreat. You know, that's the only, that we had released that. That was going to be for me to, you know, promoting. So that was already released. So now what are we going to do? Now people are not going to hear from me again until months. You know, so he's like, well, we're going to animate it. And they did the animation.
Right, since you couldn't appear in it live.
Yeah, I couldn't appear in it. So they did the animation. I was like, oh, that's going to be great. And I'm laying in the hospital when I see this. I was like, wow. I mean, for one thing, the drawing and the shoes and the dress, it was so cute. And I said, they even put my mole. They had the mole on the side of my head, which was great. And I'm looking at this film, and I'm like, wow, it's like, it's telling another story. And Sandra, my background singer, Sandra comes up, you know, Sharon, that video is like just telling the people, like the little wolves chasing you around, that's like the cancer, and how you just outgrew it and you just came back and you broke your mic out of the rock and you picked it up and you start walking over the world like telling, hey world, I'm back. And that video and seeing that took on a different meaning just like another song, Get Up and Get Out, that took on a different meaning. We changed that from, you hear Get Up and Get Out on the album, it sounded almost like a country western, a gospel, but then when I do it live, it's like a Tina Turner Rolling on the River type. I start it off slow and do it fast, and I say, not only do I say Get Up and Get Out, I tell the cancer to get up and get out. And if you don't get up and get out, I'm going to shout you out, and I get to shout. And I do that song each night because that lets the people know that if I got the energy to stand there and shout and sing that song, that's a high-energy song. And I do that for me to let me know that I still got the energy. And at night, that's sort of like a ritual song for me to do. I get to express myself.
All right. So this is Sharon Jones singing Retreat with the Dap Kings. And this is on the soundtrack for the new documentary about her, Miss Sharon Jones. Sharon Jones singing Retreat with the Dap Kings backing her up, and that song is on the soundtrack for the new documentary about her, which is called Miss Sharon Jones. I want to go back a little bit to your very early singing career. Before you made it as a singer with the Dap Kings, doing your songs, doing the songs that were really for you, you sang in a wedding band. Did you do covers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's all we did was covers in the wedding band. The name of my wedding band, well, we had two names. They started out with the John Lawrence Orchestra. And then later on, it turned to Good and Plenty. and believe it or not, that's how I met Sondra and Star.
So your backup Star singers.
They've been with me since the early 90s. And backup, you know, we did the Learn the Hard Way album. And, you know, you go in the studio, some of the first early recording, I did a lot of the backgrounds myself, you know, tripled up on them. And then later we would get a couple of singers in, and I still would sing with them, too. I would be third person in that backing up of the album. But Sondra and Star have been singing so long together, the three of us. And after going on the road with I Learned the Hard Way, and no harm, I have, you know, Binky and Gabe and Fernando, my conga player, they're like, oh, don't worry, we do the background for you. And, you know, Fernando have that little accent. And so we went on the road, and I'm hearing, I learned the hard way. I learned the hard way, baby. I'm like, oh, my God, we're going to get some background singers right now. And so we would start traveling. They would hire some, you know, like if we go over in Europe, over in Australia, they had some sisters that got them. We'd be in the States. I said, look, we got to get somebody that's permanent. And along came Sondra and gave them, like, this would be good for Sharon. She needs this, you know, and I'm back out there on that road. And there you go. They came in and they was there with me and been that supportive. They helped me over the last five, going on 6 years now. So they've been behind me these last 6 years and being away from the wedding and knowing each other. So we've been around each other good some years in here with us, 18, 20 years. We got some time of our friendship and backing up and singing together. So it's great having them, such a ease, such a comfort. And now that they have their own album out, Son and Star, Big Will, they also get to open up for me those nights that I have that long show now. And if I have to do an hour and a half, they come out and do 3 or 4 songs maybe, you know. And if I need to go off and come back, they got me, you know, up there. So mm-hmm. it's all working out for the great, and I'm so glad they're there.
The Dap Kings has a great horn section, including a baritone horn. So that that gives such body to the sound, like rhythm and body. And what's it like for you as a singer to have these great horns behind you?
Oh, that's all. They're there. And, you know, and it reminds me of, you know, you look back on the day you get records and you put them on, and to hear a good horn solo, to, like, be playing something, something going on, like, take a solo right there. You know, to hear that, and these guys are being such great musicians, you know, instead of that synthesizer, anybody going to press a button, and, you know, you know, you get the drum machine. I mean, I want to hear the drum, stop, break it down, like, make it soft, you know, different stuff like that. Or you can stop him on a dime, blah, and come back in. You know, what the Dap Kings and I have over the years, you know, being out there so long, to like, we just feed off of each other. I can call something, a lot of nights they have no idea what I'm gonna do, or who I'm gonna call, or where I'm gonna go with this song. I don't even know. I just take it as I get up there and how I feel, and I go with it. So. Great musicians, that horn, they step, and I like to see them over there stepping. I got to get with them. They got to get some more steps. They got to get some more stepping going on here. You know?
A lot of the songs you sing are written by Gabriel Roth, who writes under the name Bosco Mann and mm-hmm. is the leader of the Dap Kings. When he writes a song for you, how do you learn it? Does he make a recording for you? Does he sit at the piano and play it?
No. Yeah, well, he don't play that, make that recording for me, because then you're trying to show me how to sing it. He'll come in, he have the idea. He'll play something on the piano, bing, 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 you know. And I go, oh, okay. He's not a singer, so I have to hear where he's going. I just take the music and hear his idea, and then I go with it from there. You know, basically he give me what he think, but I have to do it my way, because I'm the soul singer. They're not soul singers, so you can't teach me how to sing soul. You can tell me where to go and just allow me to be myself, and that's the what we have there with these guys. You know, a couple of times they got in, they thought they had to try to give me some tracks and stuff, and I nipped that in the bud right away. You know, you could take that away from here, because I'm listening to this track and listen to somebody else singing. I'm trying to go where they're going, and that's not where I would go. I would go nowhere, sing that song. You can get 5 singers in here, and each one of us going to sing that song differently, so... You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. just let me be me. And that's how we've gotten where we are today at Dap Tone, by them letting me sing the way I feel it.
Sharon Jones, it's just been great to talk with you. I wish you good luck with your health and with, you know, with the chemo. And I'm so glad you're still performing.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep on keeping on as long as I got my health and strength, and God give me that will to do it.
Sharon Jones is the subject of the new documentary, Miss Sharon Jones. It opens in New York tomorrow, L.A. next Friday, and in other cities in the weeks to come. After a break, our linguist Jeff Nunberg will trace the evolution of the slogan Law and Order, which has been adapted by the Trump campaign. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Donald Trump's pledge to be the law and order candidate revived a slogan that's associated with Richard Nixon's 1968 presidential campaign. Many people have heard that phrase as racially coded then and now. But as our Fresh Air linguist Jeff Nunberg notes, its resonances aren't quite the same as they were back then.
I am the law and order candidate. With that proclamation in his acceptance speech, Donald Trump made it official that he'd be recycling the themes and language of Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign. A lot of observers were quick to point out that 2016 is no 1968, and that Donald Trump is no Richard Nixon. But then, law and order isn't what it once was either. Law and order, it's an archaic expression from the Latin lex et ordo. Over the course of American history, it's the cry the people in charge have raised to confront the threat of violence bubbling up from below, whether as popular insurrections, public disorders, radical agitators, or gangs. It was the phrase invoked to condemn the striking auto workers in Flint in 1936 and the demonstrations organized by Martin Luther King in Birmingham in 1963. But for most Americans of the Nixon era, law and order was saturated with the mythology of the Old West. Hollywood made at least 5 Western films with that very title, most with the same tried-and-true plot: a lawman reluctantly takes up his badge one last time to clear out the ruffians who have been terrorizing the decent folks of Dodge or Tombstone. Ronald Reagan starred in the 1953 film of that name. 13 years later, he revived the role of the new sheriff in town to win the California governorship, running as a citizen politician who could restore law and order in the wake of the Watts riots and the disorders at Berkeley. By the time Nixon and George Wallace adopted the law and order slogan in 1968, the phrase was everywhere in the air. The social fabric seemed to be coming apart at the seams. The assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, the urban riots, the Weathermen and the Panthers, the street protests and campus upheavals, and a violent crime rate that had risen alarmingly over the course of the decade. By August of 1968, voters saw law and order as the most important issue facing the nation, ahead even of the Vietnam War. Nixon publicly denied that the phrase was a code for racism. The very accusation implied a reverse racism, he said, as if the critics were suggesting that the Negroes didn't want law and order too. But the message was clear enough in Nixon's references to a city jungle that threatened to swallow the affluent suburbs. His TV ads showed a middle-aged white woman walking nervously down a city street at night, where the assailants who might be lurking in the shadows presumably weren't Abby Hoffman or Jerry Rubin. This was a new maneuver in modern American political rhetoric. Even in the South, most Americans had repudiated explicit racism. Now, crude appeals to bias had to be replaced by phrases that obliquely brought racial images to mind. People often describe these phrases as racial dog whistles, which send a signal that's only audible to one part of the audience. But the racial connections are usually pretty obvious to everyone. You don't need a Captain Midnight decoder ring to know that welfare queens or inner-city culture are references to minorities, no more than to know that Park Avenue is a reference to the rich. Those phrases are less like dog whistles than like Pavlov's bells. All the dogs can hear them, but they only salivate if they've been conditioned to respond. The important thing is that they leave you room to deny the associations to yourself and to others. And they provide the opportunity for a kind of rhetorical jujitsu in response, where you turn the charge of racism against your critics. Somebody taxes you with racism for a remark about bands of youths in hoodies, and you indignantly point out that Mark Zuckerberg wears a hoodie, and they're the ones with race on the brain. In the past, these racial bells have usually been abandoned when their associations became too obvious to be plausibly denied. The phrase states' rights is so tarnished by its association with segregation that nobody uses it now. If you want to object to federal control of some policy or program, you have to say the issue should be left to the states. Law and order lasted as a political slogan into the 1990s. Bill Clinton invoked it to justify both tougher penalties and community programs. But by the turn of the century, the phrase was out of fashion, other than as the punning title of a popular TV series about cops and prosecutors. That owes something to the dramatic decline in violent crime since then, even if public perceptions haven't entirely caught up with it. But the public attention had turned by then to other kinds of criminality: Enron and Madoff, cybercrime and mortgage scams. Trump's single-handed effort to revive the slogan law and order is the key to creating the perception of a new crisis of crime and violence, which weaves together the assaults by Muslim terrorists, inner-city thugs, and illegal immigrants. The racial overtones of the phrase are harder to deny now than they were in the Nixon years, when white radicals and students were part of the mix. But deniability isn't as important as it used to be. In the new rhetorical climate, these phrases are mostly designed to troll the other side for its political correctness. Still, the phrase law and order itself sounds a little creaky now. It doesn't have the mythical resonance as it did 50 years ago. When Trump uses it, it makes people think of Richard Nixon. When Nixon used it, it made them think of Wyatt Earp. But they're not making those movies anymore.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interview with Michael K. Williams, who co-starred in The Wire as Omar and is now in the HBO series The Night Of, check out our podcast. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Squarespace, an all-in-one website builder for bringing a project, business, or portfolio to life online with templates, custom domains, and 24/7 support. Learn more at squarespace.com.